The Will Cain Show podcast is presented by Eno, the Capital One assistant. What's in your wallet?
Hey, what's up, folks? On today's Will Cain Show interview podcast, I get to hang out with somebody that puts a smile on my face almost every time I see him. It's my friend, my colleague, ESPN football analyst, Marcus Spears. Now, one of the reasons I feel decent calling Marcus my friend, definitely somebody that I like, is that I think that he's almost 100% real. I say almost because you never know with anybody, much less people you work with. But I like Marcus. That I know with 100% truth. I love talking to him about his experience getting drafted by Bill Parcells, what it was like to play under Parcells, what he likes to hunt. We have that in common, although we rank our game animals differently. And we got into this business the same way. Stick in till the end of the podcast and you'll hear the little trick that both of us pulled to make our way into the media business. I always enjoy hanging out with Marcus Spears. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Marcus Spears, it's 2005. You're just drafted by the Dallas Cowboys, 20th overall. You finally make your way to Dallas. What is your first impression of Bill Parcells?
Oh, man. It was funny, man, because I knew a little bit about Bill before, because I obviously played for Saban, and he knew Bill, so I was able to get some intel. But my first impression was kind of a Hall of Fame coach who is an a-hole. That's really what it was. The phone call on draft day, I'll never forget, Jerry called and said, "Hey, man, we're taking you with the 20th pick. Congratulations. Can't wait to get you to Dallas. So excited we were able to get you and DeMarcus Ware in the first round." And then Bill picked up the phone and said, "I need you at 3:10 when you show up to camp. I'll see you soon." And that was it.
No welcome to Dallas. No happy to have you. Get your weight down. See you soon.
Nothing. And my weight was actually lower than that at the time. But I guess he felt like that was what he needed to say. So I couldn't stand him from the beginning.
How did it go after that, Marcus? Was that kind of the nature of the relationship? It was always frosty. It was always authoritarian. Was he always an a-hole?
It sucked for about the first maybe year and a half, until I realized what he tried to do and was able to talk to a bunch of players. That's my dog. He'd been pissed off about Parcells. realized what he was trying to do, man. And being around a lot of veterans that had played for him already tremendously helped me, because I was able to have conversations with them about when they first started out with him. So a lot of things that they had went through, and they ended up being good players and playing for a long time, drew a lot of parallels to what myself and DeMarcus was going through as well. So and I had a big rookie class where a lot of us was playing early. A lot of us was a big part of what we were doing defensively for the Cowboys. So we all kind of we absorbed the blows together, and it made it easier. But yeah, it eventually worked itself out. But it took about a year. It took about a season. I'm not going to say a year. That first season, he was killing us, because he was trying to transfer to the 3-4. He wanted to have a lot of success early. Mike Zimmer was the defense coordinator, who didn't have a lot of history in running the 3-4. So he was more a part of the actual planning and being really prevalent in meetings and stuff like that. So as a rookie class, we got it. But he told us he wanted a bunch of wolves. We were a bunch of sheeps right now. He just got us every day, pushing us. My first training camp was against Larry Allen, Flozell Adams, wildly vets, dudes that are, you know, obviously Larry Allen considered the best guard to ever play the game. And Bill did live goal line every day in training camp our rookie year. So it was just a lot, man. I mean, at times you're like, what the hell am I doing? Do I need to go back to school and sell some insurance or something? So that's what the first year was. A lot of cursing you out, a lot of telling you ain't worth a damn, and then eventually pulling back when he see you respond and start to play well, but not only play well, respond to the adversity.
You mentioned DeMarcus Ware, and you also mentioned that rookie class. It was a rookie class that the Cowboys organization and fans still talk about. That 05 class was you, DeMarcus Ware. Mm-hmm. It was Chris Canty, Jay Ratliff.
Marion Barber, Jay Ratliff. Yep.
It was awesome.
Kevin Burnett. It was a bunch of really good football players, man. And it was an exciting time for us as rookies, too, because we had a lot of us. So it was a different dynamic than, you know, you coming in with maybe two defensive players on the side that they're planning on playing. And then you got a couple guys offensively that they just trying to see if can make it in the league. We knew a lot of us would become the core and the nucleus and eventually the leaders of the team, which eventually happened. I mean, Chris moved on to New York to the Giants and won Super Bowl. But myself and D-Ware and Jay Ratliff, that core group, Kevin Burnett eventually moved on to play for Miami. Most of us had really long careers. Most of us played really well for a long time in our prospective positions. So it was a great class, man. And we felt like we should have had opportunities to at least get to NFC Championship. Didn't happen. Every time we link up or something, we'll talk about that. But at the end of the day, we had a blast playing with each other because we all came in at the same time.
You used us a lot when you were talking about Parcells, and you talked about that class being together. Did it always feel like something you guys shared, or did you feel singled out by Parcells ever?
I think every one of us felt singled out at some point. I think myself and D-Ware probably more so than others. Obviously, coming in with the first round tag and the moniker, and him being him trying to get us on the field ASAP and playing and get us ready for the NFL game, you know, as fast as possible. I tore my meniscus in training camp, so I had to even, you know, being he would exile you if you were a rookie and injured and not able to practice. So no one could talk to you on the staff, which was hell because your first training camp, I'm in Oxnard, and that's why me and Britt Brown, one of the trainers, are close to this day because me and Britt, we put the work in. Britt was the one I conversated with. He got me back on the field playing, and I played well and felt great. And our relationship developed through exile from everybody else.
How does that work, Marcus? Yeah, what does that mean, exile? You were over on the side rehabbing, and you literally couldn't talk to your position coaches, your coordinators, nobody?
Nobody. Only time you had contact with your position coach was when you were in meetings. And, you know, obviously your teammates, you talk to them. But, like, it wasn't – let me not say nobody said a word. It wasn't like people was walking around silent or avoiding you. It was no conversations of substance as far as, hey, what's going on today, or how you feeling, or anything like that. It was all, when we in meetings, it's football, and once you get done with that, you go to rehab, and you go to the weight room, and that's it. Joe Jurassic, the head strength and conditioning, there's another guy I was close with because we spent a lot of time together my rookie year. And Joe supported me, man, and got me back on my feet, him and Britt as well. So that was it for the most part. Casey Rogers was my D-line coach. Only talked to Casey when it was football time. But me and Casey cool now. And it was no rift because I understood what Bill wanted to happen. If you in rehab, are you on the sideline? You ain't a part of what we're doing. So, kick rocks.
That's how it was explained. You're not a part of the team right now until you get back. Don't act like you're part of us. Get yourself back.
That's it. And imagine that, Will, as a 21-year-old, first time in the league, expectations to be this great player for a long time. And that's like – and this happened the first or second practice in camp, Steven Peterman fell into my knee. And that was it. I had to go to rehab. And then I got back, like, towards the end of preseason. And I never forget, I think we played the Ravens in the preseason. I had, like, two sacks and a bunch of tackles, made some plays. And then you could tell, like, everything started kind of opening up.
The other day on the radio show, you and I were talking about your time with Saban, and you told me a story about when he wanted to change positions. I'm not going to make you retell that story. Anybody that wants to see it or hear it can go to my Instagram. It's up there. But it's an awesome story about your relationship with Saban and when he asked you to move from tight end to defensive end. When you were with Parcells, was there a low moment for you? Was there, you mentioned, hey, I kind of think maybe I should go sell insurance or something. Was there a time there in the early days where you're like, this may not be for me?
That, man, I mean, I think that what I just talked about was, that early on, football never was hard for me. I like the actual playing of the game was never hard. Whatever my job was, I did it and did it at a pretty high level. Now, it was nothing I was accustomed to in college, because in college I got sacks and interceptions and did all that, but that wasn't my responsibility in Dallas. I think my low points were the games being played, like the mental games that Bill would play, and just getting to the point where you realize what the game was, and then you could respond and react and do what you needed to do. But Bill was one of those type of guys, like, he wanted to see if you were going to bite back, and it took me a while to figure that out. And then when I finally bit back, our relationship grew.
What does that mean, bit back?
Understood.
Like, yell at him back?
Hell yeah. Yell at him back, curse him back, not in no disrespectful way in front of everybody, just in a – well, it would be disrespectful to conventional people that's looking at it, but in a football way, he would push you and see if you had some dog in you, some fight in you. So that's really what it boiled down to. And once – and you got to – you understand, man, you got to feel like you've established at least enough, or you've done – something of substance to be able to do that. And finally, you know, I got to a point where I was tired of hearing it every day. And, you know, we were playing well, defense was playing well, and just snapped back. And after that, I noticed that our conversations and our run-ins were more about, you know, more from a not equal, he's still a head coach and still had the authority, but it was more of a grown man conversation as opposed to this young rookie guy that I'm going to run over until, you know, he figure out that he need to stand up for himself or whatever.
Now, I want you to hear me out. I'm going to tell you a story, and don't think I'm trying to compare my collegiate water polo career to your elite athleticism, okay? But I know you were the number one tight end recruit in the nation coming out of high school. I know you were a big-time basketball recruit coming out of high school as well. I played water polo at Pepperdine, and Pepperdine was a top 10 program in the country out in California. And I'll remember, Marcus, I was a pretty fast swimmer, and I remember getting on the deck and saying, okay, there's the fast guys and there's the big guys. And the big guys in water polo are about 250, and they weren't chiseled like Greek gods. They looked like they had an extra tire. And you're thinking, that's guy built on muscle, and these guys over here are built on speed. I'm with the speed guys. It was within my first practice or two, Marcus, I'm like, oh no, there's not two groups, it's one group. The fast guys are strong and the big guys are fast, and I'm just not either of these two. Now that was my experience, okay? What I'm curious about you is, did you ever hit another level where you were like, oh, this is different? You mentioned Larry Allen. What I learned that first practice or two is what a Division I athlete was, right? And a lot of those guys went on to be Olympians, and I'm like, this is different. You mentioned that practice against Larry Allen. As an elite basketball player, an elite offensive tight end who got switched defensive end, was a first-round draft pick, did you ever hit a guy or hit a level where you're like, oh, this just changed big time?
Well, L.A., Larry Allen, who you just – that was different. But that's Hall of Fame. That's great as ever, Will. And to be honest with you, and not to sound boastful or anything, outside of – Larry Allen and probably Jonathan Ogden, Willie Rofe, and notice that's three Hall of Famers I just mentioned. Everybody else, I felt like at some point I'd be on that level or be able to play and compete from an athletic standpoint and just learning the game and being a veteran. But those three guys, it felt like it was no way to get to that level. And I guess that's the difference. I saw that. I saw D. Ware develop into being that guy for a lot of guys. Like, there's no way I'm going to get to that level. When T.O. came to Dallas, you saw what the level looked like of a Hall of Famer. So, look, man, these dudes with these gold jackets, you got to realize they better than the best.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the NFL is the best, or they were the best at some point. Or they were one of the best, or one of the elite. If you playing in the league, there is something elite about you. It's not just by happenstance that you become a good player or a starter for a number of years in the NFL, unless you bring in some kind of quality of high level eliteness. And when you have guys that supersede that, and you start getting the Hall of Fame, best, greatest of all time, there's a significant difference in those guys. And for me, that was Larry Allen. My first couple practices against Larry Allen, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this, a couple times walking off the field, I thought to myself, my own inner voice was like, I can't play this game if it's like this every Sunday. Like, there's no way I'm going to develop and become what I need to become if every guy I play like this against, every guy I play against is like this. And, you know, I think that's a point of doubt that every athlete has at some point when you play against somebody like that. But then something in you, man, just won't allow you to accept that. So it was just an everyday, how do I get better? How do I work around it? And I'll say out of the 1,000 times that I went against Larry Allen, I probably beat him like 10, but I'm holding on to them, son of a gun.
I don't think you're being boastful. I think you're being accurate. You're a world-class athlete who saw that level, and that level that one that hit you in the face was Hall of Fame level, the gold jacket level, which
yes.
you just described to us,
yes.
is just another level
yes.
for you.
And, Will, it's a difference, man. I wish people could understand it, because I think sometimes you and I specifically, we're around sports, and we are around these athletes. We get a chance to have conversations with them and talk to them. And we know a lot about the game. We have a historical connection to the game from when we started watching it. I don't think people realize what it means to be Hall of Fame level. I really don't. Like, I think they take it for granted that when you have guys playing on Hall of Fame levels, they are better than the best the world has to offer. And sometimes I don't think we put that in context. You know, coming off this Last Dance with Jordan and this conversation about LeBron, and we can have it. It's fun to have that debate. But at the end of the day, Jordan and LeBron are so much more elite than the guys that are considered the best that it really shouldn't ever evolve into a conversation about who's the best or the greatest between them. They are better than everybody that is considered the best at that. Because if you're playing pro ball or if you reach that level, you are considered the best at what you do in the world. Like, there is no other NBA. There are obviously professional leagues all around the country. Luka is one of the best of all of the professional leagues. I would say the guys that are in NBA are the best that the world has offered. Now, there are some guys that could be playing, like, we don't dismiss that. But I have had the opportunity to be around four Hall of Fame players. In DeMarcus Ware, who's going to be a Hall of Famer, T.O., Jason Witten, and Larry Allen. And I'm going to tell you, their level is above the level of the best. So I don't know what the hell you call that.
On that note, let me ask you, who's the hardest person you ever had to defend? Let's do it two ways. I'm going to ask you this. Who's the hardest person you ever had to tackle? I guess that puts it out of the quarterback realm. And I'll ask you second, who's the best quarterback you ever had to deal with? And I guess that factors in time you had to get to him, decision making he had in his pocket, all of that. So let's go with tackle first. Who's the hardest person you ever had to tackle?
LaDainian Tomlinson, another Hall of Famer. Two things worked in LaDainian's advantage. You had to find him amongst the fray of the big fellas up front. And then when you found him, his balance, his strength, and his ability to see you without looking at you was uncanny. And not to get too deep into the intricacies of football, but what makes the great backs is that their vision is two or three levels ahead of where their next move is. So they know you're beat. They know they are going to beat you at the first line. They're focused on the safety before they break through the first line. And that's kind of hard for people to understand, but that second and third level vision of knowing, I'm not worried about this defensive lineman tackling me. I'm not even worried about this linebacker. Let me focus on this safety where this defense has been designed for him to be the one-on-one matchup, and if he doesn't make the play, I'm a win. So that's
hey,
why
Marcus, let me ask you this. When we use the word vision, yeah, sometimes I think we think of eyes. I want to run this by you when you're talking about this, and you tell me if you agree. I talk about this on my show, mm-hmm, and I talk about it with my sons, both of whom play soccer. There was this fighter, yeah, pilot back in the 30s or 40s. He designed the F-16, and he developed this acronym. It's called OODA Loop, right? It's O-O-D-A, uh-huh, and then loop. And it stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. And what it is about the guy whose mental processing is one or two steps, literally sometimes, you know, 3 or 4 seconds ahead of everybody else, yeah, on the field. So when you're describing Tomlinson, these guys with vision, and that's something people said about Emmitt Smith, he didn't have the moves that Barry Sanders had. He didn't have the speed that O.J. Mm-hmm. Simpson had, but he had vision everybody talked about. What I hear you talking, yep, about, and you tell me if you think I'm off or on here, is it's actually not like their eyes are better. It's their mind.
It's
where their mind, yep, is focused. They're playing chess or checkers so many steps ahead of everybody else. It's their OODA is looping faster. You see what I'm saying?
No question. That is a part of it. And then the feel, the time and space. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you just said. They know more about how much time and how much space they have to do what they need to do, processing that before anybody else does. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that about a couple. T.O. was like that. T.O. knew where he was going before you could diagnose how he was going to get there. That's why so many DBs, because people look at T.O., he's big. And I'm sure Randy was like that, who worked Randy Moss. I'm sure, like, we're talking elite, though. We're having a conversation about guys that are off the charts. They are not only – being a superior athlete ain't all that when you get to the pros. It's a bunch of them. But to your point, the OODA and the ability to diagnose time and space before people do – before most professional athletes who live and breathe this daily, is special. And so that was my hardest to tackle guy.
Okay.
And from a processing like quarterback, as far as seeing him process and be able to stay ahead of everything, I would say Brady and Peyton. Probably, and for me personally, more so Peyton, because I played Peyton when I went to my last year in Baltimore. He threw 6 touchdowns on us. It had nothing to do with his athletic ability. His neck was jacked up. Back to your point, he just processed everything so much faster than everybody else. And in turn, his teammates knew. It's almost like, Will, if I told you this is an example of great quarterbacks, right? Not just being able to throw the ball. That's why you don't need to have a cannon to play quarterback and be super successful. If I told you, Will, there's a radio station in Washington, and I want you to go to that radio station. I want you to get in front of the mic at 3 o'clock, and I just want you to go and do your radio show. And a couple of weeks later, the programming director comes in, or the owner of the station, and says, Will, we want to sign you to a 5-year, $15 million contract to do radio from this radio station in Washington. 5 days a week, and that's what we going to – that is where – that is – I hope that you like that. That's how it is playing receiver for guys like Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and playing on teams with LeBron James and Michael Jordan. Go to this spot, Steve Kerr. I'm going to throw you the ball at 3 o'clock. Just do what you do best. Shoot it, knock the shot down. You'll get a contract for years. Tristan Thompson, I'm LeBron James. Go to the rack. After when I tell you to crash the boards, crash the boards. You're going to get rebounds. You're going to get putbacks. You'll get a 5-year, $82 million deal. With Peyton, as far as great as the Reggie, run this goal. You're going to be wide open. Run this comeback, Marvin, or run this cross-country route, Marvin Harrison. I'm going to hit you on the 20 on the opposite side. You're going to be wide open. Go to the end zone. That's what those type of guys do differently than everybody else. You know, we talk about the cannon that Aaron Rodgers and Pat Mahomes have, and they have process. They have the mental process, and a lot of their stuff is still athletic, and they can move the chains in that way. But those two guys in my career were the ones that said, I can set up all of the 10 guys by what I do and how I process to be successful, and they better players for it.
You talking about quarterbacks and talking about that example of negotiating a contract off of a quick sample of me doing a radio show in Washington or whatever it may be reminds me of this story, and I want to see if you know anything about it or what your version of this is. I heard that in training camp, Parcells and Jerry Jones realized that Tony Romo might be the quarterback of the future, or rather will be the quarterback of the future. And Bledsoe's already there. He's still there.
Yep.
But they haven't told Tony that yet. They haven't given him the job, which happened mid-season. And the story goes, they cornered Tony in the locker room together, Hall of Fame coach, Hall of Fame owner, and attempted to negotiate a contract with him right there. Let's get this done. Let's get you a long-term deal. Let's keep you as a Dallas Cowboy. And he had the confidence to say, no, I'm not doing that right now. Let's go ahead and play this out and see where this goes, or let's get my agent.
Yeah, we heard that. It didn't happen. I don't recall them cornering him in the locker room, but I did hear of them trying to get a deal done with him based on his potential, as opposed to, nah, this is what I'm going to do and put myself in the conversation to be the highest paid. But I'm to that, Will, we saw that with Tony in practice. Tony would kill us on the scout team, bro. So basically what happens is your starter practices with the ones throughout the season. He getting the game plan. That was Drew for a time. And then Tony slowly start creeping in and getting a few reps at the one with the ones. But Tony, for the most part, would be scouting, and he would run the plays of the other team that we were facing that Sunday. And he would rip us. He would have athleticism, elusive, all of that. Now, we didn't hit in practice anything like that, but you could tell the way the ball was coming out of his own, his command, how he had the scout team guys in sync and in line. Goes back to what I was talking about with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. How he processed the game, how he could look at, let's say, Washington, the Redskins plays, and have them down and be able to run a seamless practice in scouting. Those are the type of things you evaluate your backups on most of the time. And as defensive guys, we get the firsthand look because we're going against him every week because he's giving us a look for what's going to happen on Sunday. So we all saw it. But that is true. I do remember vaguely that conversation about them trying to come in and, you know, obviously give Tony a deal based on what they thought he could be as opposed to what he knew he was. And he turned it down. He had that confidence. And look, man, it is the NFL. When you're getting big deals, it ain't nothing but betting on yourself most of the time, or being in a great situation, in a great position to do what you do best. And I've seen that time and time again.
How does that work? The defensive guys start whispering about it first, you said? You start going, oh, my God, I think this
Hell
scout
yeah.
team might be better than our starter?
And it ain't no whisper.
Oh,
it
really?
Ain't no whisper. I mean, you don't tell that to the coaches. I mean, we had a tremendous amount of respect for Drew. You ain't going to your coaches and being like, hey, man, Tony should be playing. But it would be conversations in the locker room like, damn, man, Nine killed us today. And coaches would hear it. They would get wind of it. And it wasn't like they wasn't out there seeing him cooking either during scout team. And even when he went in and got a few reps and went to ones and had to run some plays and stuff like that. But, yeah, as defensive players, you like, bro, I don't know. I don't know how long Drew going to be playing or starting. Like, this dude here, that's why practice is important. Will, people talk about these quarterback battles and we have an assumption. You know, it's a few guys where we know every year this is going to be the starter, no matter what the backups do. But a lot of these jobs, like when we get to the college level, you could tell a lot about how a guy responding in practice, man, and what he's doing on a daily basis in practice. So it was just for Tony, as defensive players, we're like, if he cooking us and we one of the top five, top ten defenses in the league, we might need to see what he can do on Sunday against other defenses.
Hey, what makes Jerry Jones different? We have this conception in media and in fandom that Jerry is hyper-involved. Mm-hmm. He's meddlesome. You played for the Cowboys, so it's really your only major experience. You had a year with the Ravens as well to see how another owner handles it. But is Jerry walking the locker room? Is he talking to players? Is he the guy that can undercut authority and hierarchy because he's always there for a player to come give him his time and his thoughts? Is that what it is?
I've said this before, Will. Let me say this to you and the listeners. At the foundation, Jerry wants to win. And that's what you respect about him playing for the Dallas Cowboys at the foundation. Some of the things he does, you don't respect how he's doing them. It can feel sideshowish. It can feel carnivalist. It can feel a lot of different ways because of the things that he does, the access that he gives the media on a daily basis. Sometimes that gets tiresome for players. You know, we practiced one time in the new Cowboy Stadium. And while not one time, we practiced there a few times, but a couple practices that we had there while we're practicing, there are stadium tours going on there. Those are the things that you notice when you become older as a player. Like, how the hell we know who these people are at practice? Never forget, we was getting ready to play the Bears one week, and the field, they had tours on the field while we were practicing. Those type of things are super frustrating. I mean, you know the story. You around Dallas. Jerry wanted T.O. Bill didn't. So when you talk about undercutting or, you know, flexing his level of authority in certain situations, yes. How much power does a head coach have when a player could go over his head and talk to the owner and be like, all right, this is the way we're going to do it? So I think at Jerry's core, what all the things that he does, he think is for the best. He think that is the foundation and the way you go about trying to get a championship. He loves his players. His guys. Like, he has his guys that he's going to take. He's going to take care of Mike Irvin forever. He's going to take care of Emmitt forever. And people say it's about a Super Bowl. No, these dudes are like Jerry's family. And everybody's not like that. Me and Jerry cool. I don't call him. He don't call me. We see each other. It's very cordial. We speak, you know, catch up. But it's not like, you know, one of those outspoken relationships where, like, Mike Irvin and Emmitt and I'm not sure if Troy and – I know they close, but I'm not sure if Troy going to the Thanksgiving dinners and all of that. But with that being said, man, it's good and bad. You know what I'm saying, Will? It's just like any team dynamic. You got stuff you like, you got stuff that you don't like, and you got to decide what side you want to fall on. I preferred the side of Jerry where I knew at his core he was trying to put us in a position to win and give us the best chance to do that. So I chose to look at that side of it, and not saying other things didn't frustrate you, but at the same time, you knew at the core he wanted to win. So you tried to overcome the things that weren't really necessarily conducive. I didn't like the fact that Jason Garrett was making more money than Wade Phillips when he was the head coach in the OC. But that was Jerry. Jerry wanted at some point for Jason Garrett to be the head coach. We all knew it. Wade just had a lot of success his first 2 years. So it's just, you know, it is what it is, man. And I don't get, you know, I understand it. You have sat with Stephen A. I've sat with Stephen A. We've listened to people talk about the Cowboys ain't going to win nothing until Jerry get out of the way. And I feel like that in certain regards. But in certain regards, I feel like the Cowboys aren't who they are. Obviously, without Jerry Jones, I think sometimes his meddling and things that he probably should just stay away from takes away people's authority to do their job fully. And I think that's the biggest issue that Dallas has had.
I want to go back to you for a minute. I want to talk about you. One of the things I've liked about you from the beginning is I feel like you are who you are. I don't feel like there's much of a hidden agenda. I don't think you're hiding a big portion of your personality. I can't pretend like you and I know each other really well. Yeah. We've socialized once or twice, and we've talked on and off air for a couple of years. But I've always felt that way about you. And you grew up in Baton Rouge. You probably were always the dominant athlete. For some reason, and I don't know, maybe this is me, maybe this is you. You're one of the few black hunting enthusiasts that I know in my life. So I don't know if you're rare or I'm ignorant on that fact, but I'm not saying you're the only. I'm not saying you're the only. Yeah, it's rare, right? And so
it's rare.
When did you start hunting? How old were you when you started hunting?
I was 9. Started rabbit hunting with dogs and shotguns. And always fished. My uncle, Duke, was the one that took me deer hunting for the first time. And I'm climbing a stand. I used a tree climber stand the first time I hunted, Will. So I didn't know the trees sway like that when you get up top. So I'm terrified and nervous. But I saw a doe walk out. Female deer, and from that point on, I was hooked. I never didn't harvest her, didn't pull the trigger, nothing. I just saw her, and something about it just grabbed me, and I was like, I want to do this. And then that evolved into turkey hunting, and that evolved into duck hunting and everything. So I got one rule when it comes to hunting, man. If I can't eat it, I'm not going to kill it. Mm. And that's always been my thing. So you won't see me on no African safari looking for no lions and jaguars and all of that. I just don't believe in that. I know a lot of guys like to do it. I don't think those animals should be used as trophies. But it is what it is. To each his own.
Hey, Marcus, we're 100% the same on that, by the way. I'm not mad at guys that do that. That's not going to be my cause to fight. You know, I understand that those fees pay for conservation. I understand everything about it, you know, but I'm the same way. Personally, it doesn't feel good for me when it's done for a trophy. It feels good to me and fun if I'm part of the natural food chain. Do you see what I'm saying? It's the way, because man has done this from the beginning of time, and I think doing it actually takes us back.
I tell people that all the time. If you eat meat, don't tell me nothing about hunting.
Right.
Just don't tell me that. And then for the people that don't eat meat, you choose not to eat meat. I do. So I'm more, Will, it's crazy. My wife and I, we have these conversations quite often. And the one thing has been great about my career is that I get a chance to do a lot of television, and I love it. It's my passion. I love doing it. The one thing it has done is taken me away from the woods, because football season is in the middle of deer season. So every chance I get, man, I try to fill my freezer up. I would love to go straight off the land. That would be my dream, to eat. All of my protein comes straight from the land. Nothing that, you know, I buy at the grocery store or whatever. But with that being said, man, it not only that, my son took his first deer last year. And to see his excitement, his emotion, for him to understand the responsibility that comes along with that. And then for us to eat deer sausage. Like, it all comes together. But I've learned I got to be honest with you. I probably learned more about life, wisdom. And to your point, me being me, I'm grounded because I don't need much, bro. Like, I don't have a desire to own a bunch of mansions and have a private jet and a bunch of nice cars. I want a couple of nice cars. I love cars. But I don't have that desire. I don't need for people to say, "Ooh, look what Marcus got." That has never been my goal. If it's something that I'm into, that's what I'm gonna do. But I'm not doing it for the approval of others. I don't need pats on the back, any of that. If the work doesn't speak for itself, then I don't know what else to tell you. And it's funny you bring that up. I was having my agent, I was having a conversation with him when we first started working together. And one of my things was, like, I was like, hey man, I'm not going to say his name for the sake of whatever. You know who he is. I was like, I'm not one of these corporate shaking hands, going to dinners every weekend type dudes. That does not mean I don't like the people I work with. That does not mean I don't appreciate the work that people are putting in. I do subtle things for the people that are working hard. Don't mind going to dinners. But I'm not one of them every week, let's sit down and have a dinner and talk about the same thing that everybody else talking about. I love wholesome, respectful conversations or wholesome, respectful relationships. And I think you and I have always had real conversations. It ain't ever been, "Will, how's the family? All right, hope they're doing good." And I don't even know your kids' names. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's always been, that's kind of, I just keep it simple, man. Like, and I'm going to stay this way, bro, because this is what's worked for me. And that I'm not saying by any means that for anybody else that does it the other way that I don't, that is wrong or it's fake or anything like that. That's just the way they choose to do it. And if it works for them, great. But this is what works for me.
What's your favorite game to hunt?
Oh, man, golly. The thrill of turkey hunting for me is the best. Because turkey hunting is very difficult. I have the most fun turkey hunting. And when I learned how to call, being able to go in the woods by myself, hunker down by a tree, call. If I don't hear nothing, move spots, call. And when I hear a gobble, I'm praying I could talk to that turkey enough to get him into range. And for the 150 to 200 times I've done it, the 10 or 12 birds I've killed, they felt like it was worth all of those other hunts that I didn't see anything. So I get the thrill of turkey hunting to me is unmatched. So that would probably be my favorite. But, Will, there is nothing like seeing a big buck emerge from the woods, bro. Like, I still get giddy, and they call it buck fever when it happens. Any deer, per se, but it is nothing like when you see that rack appear like a ghost, and you finna get it, and you about to have a freezer full of everything.
We're opposites. Okay, here's my favorite. In order, top two. Duck, one. Dove, two.
Yeah.
Now, here's why.
Okay.
You obviously like being in the woods by yourself. You clearly appreciate nature and the solitude. I like social, and I like action. So with duck,
gotcha.
I have to be calling. I have to be doing something. I'm not just sitting and waiting. And I like the action of, can I force this to happen? You know what I mean? Can I call a bird in?
Yeah.
And when they come flying in that V formation and sound like a fighter jet coming over your head, that's what I like.
I'm with you.
Dove is hanging out with your boys, right? And you can even, you know, have a beer or two. Not many, because you've got guns in your hands, and I understand all the safety implications. But you can have a good time. You can talk when you hunt dove. Dove is just a good time with your friends. And I'll tell you this. I kind of signed off on big game hunting. Like, I grew up deer hunting in Texas, and I did not like it, Marcus, because it involves a box blind, it involves a feeder, and it just all felt too manufactured for me. I moved to Montana, and I worked on a elk outfitter ranch. We took hunters out 13 miles, horseback and mule string, into the mountains, camp, and that's working for it, man. You know that. And that's hiking, that's physical, that's patience, that's everything.
That's Louisiana. That's how I grew up hunting.
Hunting deer like that?
Yeah. Marsh deer, where you go through a swamp and you hunt deer, you get off a boat, and you walk onto land and you find tracks and you plan for months. Mm-hmm. You see scrapes, you see deer trails, you see every game trails, you see all, and you set up in those spots. And for an entire season, you may see two deer. And they may be too small to shoot. So that's how I grew up. And I get you on Texas. My first Texas hunt was a high fence ranch. I had never heard of it. And 40 deer walked out. And I was like, this ain't hunting, man.
Right.
This is meat gathering. And it took a little bit of my excitement away. And not saying I don't have an appreciation for it, because some people come down and they hunt and they have these once in a lifetime experiences. But on which I would prefer the actual hunt. I would prefer stalk and be able to say I saw one, but he was 3,000 yards off or 1,000 yards off and I never could get to him. That's my preference. But go
I
ahead.
I want to cover one more thing with you. I know you got to take a walk with your wife, and this is one more thing I want to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. You and I share something in common about our media careers. In 2010, I believe it was. I can't remember the exact year. I sent an email. I had been doing television for free. I was doing it at places like Fox News. I wasn't getting paid. I was doing it to build a reel, to build a tape that an executive could see. And I sent an email to the president of CNN. I think it was like at 11 p.m. one night. His name was John Klein. And I sent him an email and said, you need somebody like me over there. And I had a link to what I had done in television so far. And he responded in 15 minutes. He said, you know what? You're right.
Wow.
Come on in and let's talk. Now, there's a couple of reasons I did that, Marcus. And I did that because I knew a couple things already. Number one, I'm not afraid of no's. They don't do anything to me. So if he said no, it wasn't going to be a problem, you know. And number two, I'm not going to take a no from somebody who's not empowered to say yes. It's been a guiding principle of mine. Like, I think people spend too much time trying to get yeses from people who are only empowered to say no. So I went straight to the top, and it worked. And that's how you got on ESPN as well, isn't it?
100%. Will, that's crazy. We are very parallel in that sense. It kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the fluff conversations. So what you're saying is about the people that's empowered to say yes or no. I understand that totally. I want to talk to the decision maker. I don't want to talk to anybody else. If the decision maker says no, or some of the time, I know that is because they didn't want it to happen or it was legit not the right time. So anyway, what you're getting to, I sent one of the executives now over all of ESPN, Stephanie Drewley, who was kind of developing and putting together everything about the SEC network. She started the Longhorn Network in Austin. I sent her a tweet, and it goes back a little bit further. My sister called me after I retired. She said, have you heard about the SEC network? And I was like, yeah, because I was, you know, in NFL locker rooms, we argue about conferences. That's a real thing. And we always would talk about the SEC is better. And, you know, I remember having a real conversation about now y'all going to be able to see inside of why the SEC is what it is. And then my wife knows I have been talking about doing radio here in Dallas. I wanted to do radio. I wanted to get in my car in the morning, go do a radio show, come back home, and have nothing to do the rest of the day. That's my of what I wanted to do in media. And my wife's like, nope, you belong on TV. You're going to go and you're going to interview for that job. So anyway, I sent Stephanie a text and I said, I really would like to be on SEC Network. How do I get started? And she sent me, she DM'd me back, direct message. And she was like, well, send me some reels. Now here's how green I was. Will had no idea what the hell a reel was. I was like, a fishing reel? What you mean? I don't know what that is. And then I responded to that. Again, goes back to me. I don't need to act like I'm somebody I'm not. I legit hit her back and was like, I don't know what that means. She was like, any media you've done in Dallas. And I was like, oh, okay. Now, being in this market, Rich Dalrymple, who's over all of public relations for the Cowboys, being around Ed Werder, being around Matt Berry, playing for the Dallas Cowboys, I had a lot of relationships just by default, because I was always gracious with those guys and would have conversations and was never really a jerk with them. I had resources that I didn't necessarily know I had, but at the time when I started kind of trying to fill them out, it became prevalent to me that I had a lot of guys in the area that kind of knew. And Ed, obviously working for ESPN, being a reporter, I would ask him from time to time what was it like working there. But anyway, Stephanie hit me back, found myself a few weeks later in Bristol. I did a interview with Brock Huard. Not an interview, but you know how you go through the mock show, as your interview process. Did it with Brock, and then I heard nothing. So I was like, oh, that was a good dream. I'm going to go back to radio. And then a couple weeks later, I get a call, and Stephanie hit me up and was like, hey, I want you to come to Austin to do a follow-up interview down at Longhorn Network. And not realizing she wasn't able to be there for the first interview at Bristol, she only saw a tape. So she brought me in. We did the interview. And then I heard probably a week or two later that they were going to hire me at SEC Network. And then the following week, I heard I was going to be on the show SEC Nation, which was the live show, two-hour pregame to SEC games. And here's what I said, Will. Again, know thyself is one of the most underrated but best quality quotes that anybody can ever tell you. I told her, I was like, you know, I don't know anything about TV or doing live shows. She was like, you don't need to. You just need to be yourself. I'll teach you what you need to know. And after that, bro, here we are, what, six years later.
And you're doing awesome. You really are. Who knows where this is going to take you. You're going to be great. I don't know where it's going to take you. I just know it's going to take you far. And you're 100% right.
I totally
agree with self-awareness. Know thyself. I talk about it in terms of self-awareness. You can't take yourself where you want to go unless you know where you are and who you are.
Unless you know where you are, dude.
And
that's real, Will. And too, man, in this business – and in these circles that you and I have had the opportunity to be around people, man, you know, I guess this is wisdom from Will Cain and Marcus Spirit. Define yourself, man. Don't let other people impart what they think you should be on you. And then
they
have
will.
You thinking that that's the way I need to do things. I'm
and
a country
will,
dude.
You know, they will do
they
that.
Will. They will. I'm a country dude. I use slang. I get loud. I have a great time doing television. It ain't everybody's cup of tea, and I get that. But I'm damn sure ain't changing for the ones that don't like it.
Right, right. I like it. I'm telling you, buddy. Like I said, the greatest compliment that I can give somebody is I think that they're authentic. It doesn't mean I'm going to like them. In your case, it does. But I do like you, but you're real and you're authentic, and it's my favorite thing in people. It really is. I never feel like I'm getting
Well, that's reciprocated, man, and I've told you that before. And I'll scream it publicly or I'll scream it privately. Not that you need any of that validation. I haven't agreed with you on everything that you've said, but I respect it because I know that's Will Cain talking. And that's all I ask from anybody that I work with.
The last thing I want to let you go with before you go on this walk with your wife is take your kids out of the equation and your wedding day. I don't want to hear any of those nice cliches. I want to know, was that interception return in the national championship game the best you've ever felt in your life?
Ever. Ever. It was better than getting drafted.
Was it really?
Because Will, I'm from Baton Rouge, 45 minutes away from my home in the Superdome where my first time ever being in the Superdome, at the time it was called the Superdome, I saw Reggie White, Brett Favre play the Saints, and I was in the state finals of punt, pass, and kick. And I was able to shake Reggie White's hand, who has been my idol from the beginning of time. And I was able to shake Reggie White's hand and the minister of defense. And from then on, I wanted to be a football player. And then playing in the state championship when I was in high school and losing 24-21 to Hainesville, a team, Hainesville High School in Louisiana, the worst loss still to this date of my career, the one that I feel the most, to it all culminating in me playing for LSU, 45 minutes away from where I grew up, catching the game-winning interception to seal a national championship, the first one in 45 years for LSU. Bro, it's a book. I'm going to write it at some point, but
interception, return. You already told me you want to be a tight end because you dreamed of scoring touchdowns and getting girls, and who knew you could do it in the national championship game on defense?
Come on, man. I still got a chance to score a touchdown and get the girl. I'm married two of the day.
That's right. All right, man. Go take her for a walk. I know she's been patiently waiting. I appreciate all the time you gave me. I appreciate you, Marcus.
All right,
Thank you,
my brother.